San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, coming to you live from KFMB with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, down to Cabo, out to the desert. If you have an app for AM760.com, you could AM760, you can hear us there, or you can stream live at 760KFMB.com. And there's a variety of ways. And then we're free on iTunes, so you can search us and look us up there. This is usually the time of the show where I introduce the main man of the hour, who's a CPA extraordinaire, an accomplished marathon runner, best-selling author and a family office expert, and his name is Richard Muzio. But Richard, this evening, is tonight at a special dinner at Salk Institute with several notables, having dinner with Robert Redford. So I've got my own notables right here tonight for you, and we're going to have a great time. So anyway, we've had a couple great shows over the last couple of weeks. I wanted to thank again the Chancellor of UCSD, Pradeep Khosla, for a wonderful show. Received some very nice feedback on his appearance from none other than Irwin Jacobs. So if you're pleasing Irwin Jacobs, you're doing something right. And also the dinner last week up at the estate up in La Jolla Farms, the Berry Goodnight Dinner, fifth annual, another fantastic evening with eight guests. So, let's see. I'm getting over a little bit of a head cold. If my voice is a little raspy, I apologize. I know there's some kind of an allergy or cold going around. And all I could say is green tea, honey, and lemon, folks, and keep after that. That usually will help. So I'm the best I've sounded in about 4 or 5 days now. So I think I'll be fine tomorrow. And let's see. This past week, there were two special memorials this past Thursday. Of course, everyone knows down at Petco Park, the great Tony Gwynn had the memorial down there for him. And what a great icon in this county. But also that afternoon, there was a memorial for a very dear friend who was an executive here for many years and well-known in the TV and advertising community. And we had a memorial for Weldon Donaldson, who was very, very big in getting the Holiday Bowl going, big with the San Diego Zoo, and just a packed house down there at Qualcomm Stadium, the Stadium Club. And so our very best to his family. They're in our thoughts. And it was a great seeing so many of his friends there. And I guess we should start the show tonight. We've got two studio guests tonight, and tonight it's all about our waterfront and the tall ships and the history and the culture involving the maritime culture here in San Diego. And one of our guests is the president and CEO and actually executive director as well of the Maritime Museum of San Diego. He's went to UCSD. He's got some major degrees. He's a PhD, master's. He knows all about the sea. He's a great sailor, and his name is Dr. Ray Ashley. So, Ray, good evening. How are you tonight?
Doing great, Joe. Good to be here.
Good. And then also along with him, we have the chairman of the Board of Trustees with the Maritime Museum of San Diego, Dave McVain. So, Dave, how are you tonight?
I'm great. Thanks for having us.
Good. Got to get right on top of these mics and talk. So, let's start with Ray. I mean, you've got a very colorful history, and maybe you could just tell us, you know, where you grew up and how you found your way to San Diego and a little bit about your background, because I didn't fill it in all that well.
Well, San Diego's a Navy town, and my father was in the Navy, and so when he retired from the Navy, he got a job as a teacher in San Diego and moved here when I was about 8 years old. And except when I've been sailing around or going to school in other places, I've pretty much lived in San Diego my whole life. So, the job I have now really is kind of a culmination of interests that I've had all my life. I worked my way through college delivering boats places and teaching sailing. And after college, I got my captain's license and began operating vessels, mostly traditional sailing vessels, and then building them. So that was a really nice way to earn a living, or kind of earn a living, but it became increasingly incompatible with having a wife and children. Mm-hmm. So I went back to school and got a degree in underwater archaeology and museum studies, and that was actually a pretty good background to have to take the job I presently have at the Maritime Museum.
So UCSD first, and degree in what there?
Well, that was anthropology.
Anthropology. Yeah.
Pre-unemployment, I think, is what you call it.
and then master's, it was where?
Well, I got a master's degree at East Carolina University in North Carolina. Yeah. It specializes in underwater archaeology. and then a PhD at Duke University.
And tell us about that. I mean, that your specialty in there.
Well, you know, it's a history PhD, but most graduate programs require that you specialize in things. So my things were maritime history, military history, history of science, medicine, and technology.
And then you taught as well, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Fantastic. So your whole career has been involved either professionally, you know, on the sea or involved with commercial enterprise or education and all about maritime.
I think if I got too far from the water, I wouldn't know what to do. You know, so I wouldn't be good at anything else.
And of course, you did a lot of sailing yourself, right? You sailed across the ocean in a 25-foot.
Yeah, I sailed across the Pacific in a 25-foot boat, and I'm still married to the same girl I sailed across the ocean with, so that's probably the real accomplishment. You know, she stayed with me.
Now, you left from here and went, where'd you start and finish on that trip?
Oh, you know, we left from San Diego and went to Mexico, and then from Mexico to the Marquesas, so that's 3,200 miles. That took about 26 days.
Huh.
And then Tahiti, and then to the Leeward Society Islands, and then to Hawaii after that.
And then back to San Diego?
You know, actually, we sold our boat in Hawaii. And then we came back to San Diego, but that was at 20,000 feet. So that was a lot faster.
Okay. Well, wow, that's one heck of a trip. So then, so how did you get involved with the Maritimes even? When did that happen?
Well, I was just finishing up my graduate work at Duke University. And the job became, I learned of the job through a friend and applied for it. And they hired me. I was really pleased to do that. You know, coming back home, there were...
What year was that now?
That was 1995.
Huh, okay. But, I mean, the museum started when? It's been around a while, right?
1927.
27.
Yeah, the Star of India first came to San Diego as a project of the Zoological Society. So for a long time, the museum really was part of the zoo. And it became the Aquarium Committee of the Zoological Society, and then finally not the Independent Maritime Museum until 1948.
How did they bridge that gap?
Well, there was a plan at the time called the Nolan Plan that people still refer to that was the sort of the organizational, architectural, and urban planning document for San Diego's growth. And Balboa Park was the centerpiece of that. So they visualized a grand boulevard coming down Grape Street down to the water, and the zoo was one of the linchpins of Balboa Park. And this is all pertinent because, you know, we're coming up to the Balboa Park Centennial.
Yeah.
And so at the time, they envisioned, the zoo did, that aquariums were starting to get popular, and they would have a great aquarium down on the waterfront right at the foot of Grape Street. And they visualized this sort of area on the bay where there would be an enclosure with dolphins and sea lions and things swimming around, and they wanted some iconic structure in the middle of it that not only embodied, you know, marine life, but also maritime history. And somebody came up with the idea of getting an old sailing ship to house all the aquaria, the tanks and things.
Oh, my gosh.
And the last
Never
fleet.
Knew this.
Yeah, the last fleet of working sailing vessels left in the United States was a fleet of ships that were sailing from Oakland and Alameda every year up to the Gulf of Alaska to fish for salmon, the Alaska Packers Association. And so when these guys from the Zoological Society went there to buy a ship, the only one they could afford was the oldest one that was there that had been retired back in 1923, and that was a ship called the Star of India, originally built as a Euterpe. So even then, it was a very old ship. They brought it to San Diego as a centerpiece for this aquarium, and then things just sort of evolved from there.
How about that? And then, of course, then SeaWorld happened. So,
right. Well, we're not an aquarium anymore, although there's still fish swimming around the
ships. Anyone ever – it's a very, you know, unique idea. You have to appreciate the, you know, the innovation. But has anybody ever done that with any kind of a ship, made it into an aquarium? Or
not that I'm aware of, no. If you go to an aquarium, sometimes you see boats at the bottom of them, you know, as fish are swimming in and out. But that's the only case I can think of.
Anyway, we'll take a little break right now. We'll come right back with more all about the Maritime Museum on our waterfront with Dr. Ray Ashley and Dave McVeigh right after this, so hang on. All right, we are back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life, the award-winning show. You can get us free on iTunes. If I didn't mention that, I'm mentioning it again. We got two great guests tonight, Dr. Ray Ashley, CEO and Executive Director of the Maritime Museum of San Diego, and every good charitable cause needs an excellent board of trustees and a dedicated volunteers and philanthropists to help make it all work. And we have none other than the chairman of the board of trustees in here tonight with us, Dave McVane, who is a founding principal of Collins McVane Investment Partners. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Outstanding. So, Dave, tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you're you've been in San Diego a while, a very well-established and colorful career.
You know, it's interesting. Ray and I have that in common. We're both of our dads were in the Navy. And so my dad was on submarines, and I moved on to Ballast Point, the sub base out there, when I was 13 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Prior to that, being a Navy family, we had moved 9 times by the age of 13. And so I never lived far from the ocean. You know, my dad bought our first sailboat when I was 5 years old, and we started sailing Gulf of Mexico and then Charleston. I was just telling the story yesterday that when he got transferred to the West Coast, he was driving a submarine around, and he told my mom, you know, asked my mom, can you tow the boat to San Francisco, to Mare Island? And she said, well, you know, you decide, the boat or the kids. And I think he thought long and hard about which was more important. So he went out to Mare Island, lived there for 3 years while he was the commander of a submarine, the Seawolf, and came down to San Diego, and my mom bought a 29-foot cow. And when you're on nuclear submarines, you only got little family grams. They were like 50 words. It was the original tweet. And she sent him a birth announcement that you are now the proud father of a, you know, 6-ton, 29-foot sailboat. And so moved to San Diego, and I've been sailing in San Diego since I was 13, and started volunteering at the Maritime Museum about 10 years ago now, 12 years ago.
Your mother bought this boat?
I've asked her the questions, and she had some parameters, but she met a broker in San Diego, and the broker asked my mom, you know, what's your husband going to do in San Diego? And she said, well, he's going to be the Commodore. And he said, what yacht club? And she said, well, the one with the big gray ships. Yeah.
So your dad was Commodore of the Naval Base?
Yep, Submarine Development Group 1, so wow. A fleet of nuclear subs.
Holy moly. So obviously it's in your DNA, the waterfront and sailing vessels. So so when did you assume the become a trustee?
Well, I became a trustee probably about 10 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. First, you know, they blast you in. They invite you to a cocktail party, and it's all fun and games. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, I'm the treasurer, and I'm on the design committee for the San Salvador and the finance committee. And the, you know, so now it's taken quite a bit of time, but I love it. I love it. So it's a 2-year term as the chairman of the board, and we're working hard to launch the San Salvador this year. And we've been building that ship for 3 years now down by the airport. So we're trying to get that project done this year.
And, of course, it's, you know, it's not just the Star of India. Give us an idea of some of the other ships in your inventory.
Yeah, the San Salvador will be our 10th major vessel. And so, you know, we joke that we've grown from 5 vessels to 10 vessels in the last 10 years. And as I said, we started the San Salvador a little over 3 years ago now. And if you read the newspapers 3 years ago, who would have thought, you know, hey, 2009, it's a great time to plan to build a $6 million 100-foot Spanish galleon. Mm-hmm. But the board and the volunteers and the staff at the museum move forward with the support of the California Coastal Conservancy and great partnership of the community, and we're building this ship.
Well, I was looking on your website, sdmaritime.org, and at one point I saw the number of people involved there. The number of volunteers is over 1,000, right? So,
We have over 600 volunteers, about 650, but last year we had over 90,000 volunteer hours. So that's the equivalent of about 50 full-time employees. Hmm. And the San Salvador project, over half of the labor is coming from volunteers.
Isn't that something? Well, I was going to hold off on the San Salvador for the second half a little bit. We'll get into that. But anyway, in your professional life, you're managing or founding partner of Collins McVane Investment Partners. Is that correct?
Right. Prior to starting my own firm, I was working at Bank of America Trust. And 9 years ago, with my partner, Mike Collins, we set out to manage money the way money used to be managed back in the 50s before the mutual fund was invented. Mm. So we buy individual securities. We don't do any products. Mm-hmm. We're just old-fashioned money managers for wealthy families and corporations.
Mm. Well, I mean, I don't know if you listen to the show. Richard, he works. He's a family office expert as well, so you're probably a kindred spirit in a lot of ways.
I listen to the show.
Well, good for you. Well, we, you know, we get some awards here and there, so you know, people appreciate the variety of subject matter, including tonight. I mean, when else have you gotten an hour of time devoted to something as important as this? You know, it doesn't happen all that often, right?
Well, I mentioned I was chairman of the finance committee at the museum, mm-hmm. and the museum was really stretched, or is stretching and growing, mm-hmm. With our fleet of ships, and so I joke that. You know, people pointed to me and said, "Hey, let's make Dave chairman while we try to complete this project." But as you mentioned, you know, Star of India is our crown jewel. Mm-hmm. We have the USS Dolphin, which was the last diesel submarine operated by the U.S. Navy. Mm-hmm. We have a Russian Foxtrot submarine. We have the Berkeley ferry boat. We have the Medea, which is a beautiful Edwardian steam yacht. Mm-hmm. So there's something for everybody down at the museum.
And can you get onto the submarines as a visitor? You can take tours of the submarines.
Absolutely.
Well, that's cool.
For the Blue Jackets. We have a wonderful group of docents that are our most educated volunteers, and they're happy to answer all your questions.
Yeah, that's great. So everybody on your board must have some kind of connection to the sea or ships or something, right? Some kind of passion.
Yeah, they really do. But like I said, the museum, the San Salvador Project, the museum itself is such a wonderful partnership of community. One of our newest trustees is Patricia Shea, who's the president of Miramar College. Hmm. And I invited her personally to join our board because Miramar College is helping to rebuild some diesel engines that are in our Vietnam era Swift boat.
Huh.
And so we reached out to Miramar College. They agreed to help us with these engines. And now Patricia's joined our board. So It's education. It is maritime heritage. One of my favorite quotes is Martin Luther King said, "We might have all gotten here in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now."
How do you like that? that's pretty profound. It's true. You know, I at the outset, I was going to dedicate this show to my mother. Her birthday is coming up in July. We can't give out a number, but I mean the number of years. But in any case, she has been passionate. She's back in Illinois. She's been passionate about the high seas and tall ships forever. 2 years before the mast, the book by Richard Henry Dana Point. If you haven't read that one, I mean, I'm sure you guys are familiar. And there's a brig up there that's the Pilgrim replica. But anyways, this whole coast, I mean, you can't really understand the history of San Diego without understanding what's gone on in the history of our maritime community here, right? I mean, it all grew up before the city even got here, really, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, to come back to the San Salvador, if you'll forgive me, is 1542, the first European to arrive in San Diego was Cabrillo on a Spanish galleon. And it's really the way, an entry point to the United States, a founding moment in mm-hmm. North American history, was right here in San Diego by ship.
Yeah. Anyway, we were talking earlier before the show about taking out the Star of India and all the work involved in that, and we're going to get into that in the second half. But what are some of the major annual events that we should know about?
Labor Day weekend, we have Festival of Sail. That's a wonderful event. We get a bunch of tall ships to come into San Diego, and they have gun battles on the bay. It's very well attended. We're about to have the second annual Ballast Point Brewery Beer Festival.
Ooh.
Ballast Point is celebrating their 18th anniversary, and they're going to be down at the Maritime Museum Sunday, July 13th. So please come down and have some beer. Last year, it was oversubscribed. We had to shut the doors. So
you just come right down to the Star of India or where?
It's going to be all over the museum. So buy your tickets online, sdmaritime.org, because that event probably will sell out.
Huh.
So that's a wonderful thing. Another event, we had a gala last year that was the 150th birthday for the Star of India, Once Upon a Star. It was a huge success, raised almost $200,000 for the museum. This year, we're going to have a Fandango. It's going to be a pre-launch party for the San Salvador. It's going to be a traditional Portuguese and Spanish party at the build site. That's Saturday, September 27th.
Now, folks, if you've been driving to the airport from Point Loma, you can see this ship being constructed right by the Spanish landing there, right? So you're telling me they're going to take this out on... I thought they were going to just leave it there as a monument. They're going to put this in the water, huh?
We will sail
it. Yeah. I think the port would be disappointed if we didn't put it in the water, you know, since we didn't tell them that we were going to build a permanent monument. But yes, it's going in the water. We anticipate at this point that we'll be launching the ship sometime around November 12th, which is, again, the birthday of the Star of India in 1863.
Uh-huh. So. So you're just going to take it out into the bay, or out, how far out were you going with this?
You mean ultimately, or just to launch it?
Just in the launch of
it. Well, that's an interesting question. People often ask, you know, how we're going to do that, because it doesn't look very launchable where it is. And the plan now is to take it down the road, down North Harbor Drive, to a location where we can put it in the water, and there are a couple of options for that. One is the Coast Guard Air Station, where there's a seaplane ramp that was built in 1950, so we could actually put her on a giant trailer and move her back in the water that way. If that doesn't work because of limitations a Coast Guard might have, there is a point further down the bay on B Street Pier, actually, we can get – it's a very strong point. You can get a crane really close in and launch her with a floating crane from that point. Mm-hmm. But whatever the outcome is, it's going to be an amazing sight to see a 200-ton Spanish galleon going down Harbor Drive.
Yeah, I'll say. And then this is, it's 100 feet, you say?
Overall, the spar length is a little bit more than 100 feet. The on-deck length is a little bit less than
that.
And
when Cabrillo came here, was a ship just like this, right?
Well, no one knows for sure, because the actual ship went missing on a voyage in 1544 to Peru. So we don't have the actual ship, and there's no known images of it. So we've gone through years of research and a fairly forensic process to try and determine to the best of our ability what the ship would have looked like. So,
and then when he first landed in our harbor, was it just one ship, or did he have a few?
There were actually three ships. It was pretty typical in expeditions in that period that you'd have a big one, which would be the mothership, and this was the San Salvador, a middle-sized vessel, which was called the Victoria, and then a little one which could nip into little places and out again, called the San Miguel. So three ships. San Salvador was by far the biggest at 200 tons, and that would have been the most impressive ship in the Pacific at that time.
And how big a crew are you going to have when you take this out, you think?
Well, Cabrillo would have sailed on the San Salvador with about 140 human beings, so it would have been like sailing in a crowded elevator, so we won't have that many. But the ship's certified to sail with, we'll be able to carry 49 passengers, we think, is what the certificate will read, with another 12 or so crew, so not quite so many. Yeah.
Outstanding. Well, we've got to take our break now. New sports and weather coming up. We'll come back with Martha's Maritime Museum information right after this. Hang on. We are back with the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life. I am Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, producer. Richard Musio is off having dinner with a group of VIPs at Salk Institute with Robert Redford, so we can excuse him. That's a good excuse for him tonight. But anyway, time to thank our sponsors, UBS, Michael Caranta, Drew Freitas, Michael Kaniger. Great team up there serving high net worth families and doing a great job for many years. Berkeley Research Group and Carl Sheeler, one of the best business valuation guys on the planet. They do business in all 50 states, as does Joel Grushkin and Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping business owners and commercial real estate property owners improve their cash flow greatly. The accounting firm of Polito Epic up in Vista, great guys, Don Epic and Paul Polito. Richard's known them for years, and they're very highly regarded. Sean Puckett and Regents Bank in La Jolla, and banks all over San Diego, doing a great job for small businesses, and one of the best, the most trusted banks in town. And Signature Analytics and Jason Kruger, one of the best CFOs out there, serving many businesses, and he's a wonderful guy. And Brenda Geiger, who's an expert in estate and business planning in the law office of Brenda Geiger. She's terrific. And then last but not least, the Lombardi Group, who gets a lot of business professionals together at events and conferences, CPAs, law firms, et cetera. And Richard's lectured there many times, and they've been doing a great job. And Richard's worked with all of them for many, many years with great success. They're professional colleagues, not just we don't get our advertisers right out of the phone book. They're all having established track records. Anyway, if you get on your computer and get on iymoney.com and get over to sponsors, put your cursor there. There's a drop-down menu. You can find all their biographical information, their contact information, and everything you need to know. So there you have it. Anyway, back to our guests tonight, Dr. Ray Ashley and Dave McVane with the Maritime Museum of San Diego. I know we were talking about San Salvador and the launch, but I think you had a colleague who just was knighted. Do you want to talk about him for a little bit, and we'll get back into the vessels?
I'll give Ray credit for that, and we had the ambassador from Spain visit San Diego just a couple weeks ago, and it was a wonderful ceremony. And as I was introducing the ambassador and Doug, I told the story that Ray did something that he's really not supposed to do. He went off on his own without telling the board, but he knows that we can't keep secrets. And he reached out to the Casa de España here in San Diego. And Ray, why don't you tell the story?
Well, there's a lot of prominent historians have actually been acknowledged by this special order, this award, including Iris Engstrand, who's one of our board members, a very accomplished historian in San Diego. Another one of our members of our design committee, Carla Rand Phillips, probably the leading expert in the world on Spanish seafaring and the age of exploration, similar thing. So it occurred to me that what our naval architect, Doug Sharp, was doing is actually, he was actually doing a form of history just in three dimensions, not so much in writing a book, but bringing back to life something that no one has seen for hundreds of years. Hmm. And as it turns out, in the history of this order, this knightly order, back in the middle of the 19th century, there was an American ship designer named Westerveld who designed clipper ships, but he was also designing ships for the Spanish Navy, and he was given – he was knighted for that service. So that set the precedent, and we suggested the Casa de España might – propose that to the Spanish government. So the last official act by King Juan Carlos of Spain just before he abdicated was to officially knight Doug Sharp, our naval architect, for designing San Salvador. We don't think that's why he abdicated, though. We think that
well,
it was just the last
thing
on the list.
But wow, what a nice distinction. So does he get like a certificate, a sword, a cape?
Yeah, he's got a certificate, you know, and he gets a lot of ribbing from all of his friends.
he got a beautiful medal, and I was asking if he wears his medal around the build site of the San Salvador, and he said absolutely not. But Doug, he builds mega yachts. It is his real career. I mean, he builds 80-meter yachts. If you want an 80-meter yacht, call Doug Sharp.
Wow.
But as a volunteer at the museum, he has just given hours and hours of his professional time, and I don't think we could afford his services. So I call him our MVV. He is our most valuable volunteer. And he is down there on the build site meeting with our professional shipwrights and making sure this ship is built to Coast Guard regulations.
And how many people are working on that ship at any given time, or how many have total between design and construction? It must be significant, huh?
On a site, on a typical day, there'll be anywhere between 25 to 40 people working there. Half to two-thirds of them on any given day are volunteers. In addition to that, there are people off-site working at the museum, Doug in his office, right. The marine engineer, you know. So it kind of sends out, you know, their tentacles that go out to different parts of the community. But if you go there at the site any given day during the workday, you're going to see about 40 people working there.
So when did that project begin, actually, the San Salvador? I mean, it must have been a while, right?
Well, we've been working on it for about 500 years now.
I like to give credit to the Portuguese community in San Diego that they really started celebrating Cabrillo in the late 1800s. And the first time they reenacted Cabrillo's discovery of San Diego, the most exotic ship they could find was actually a Chinese fishing junk that was still operating in San Diego. And so the Portuguese community really, you know, brought Cabrillo to the public fore and said this was the guy that discovered, the European to discover San Diego. Of course, the Kumeyaay was here. There was a very vibrant culture in San Diego. But the Kumeyaay, their watercraft were reed canoes. And can you imagine seeing this huge ship with war horses and guys with silver helmets? It would have been bigger than us seeing a spaceship coming from outer space.
Yeah, boy, oh boy. You think about that.
And you know, one of the things it does allow us to do, that moment of first contact between two basically cultures. Groups of people, two cultures that were previously unaware of one another, that isn't documented very often. But we actually do have an image that's located out in the desert 60 miles to the east of here that we think is a Kumeyaay recording of that encounter.
Really?
And there's nothing, there's very few things like
that. Was it a carving in rock
something? It's a petroglyph. And if it is indeed a rendering of Cabrillo's expedition, then it's the earliest graphic representation of a recorded event in all of American history.
16 miles inland, though.
About 60 miles in the desert.
6-0.
6-0.
Boy, news travels fast.
Yeah. Well, they were in constant communication, you know, with the peoples that lived to the east. But what I was going to say is that one of the things that does allow us to do is allows us to go back to a moment in time and look at it in a slightly different way, because frankly, you know, we don't often understand really the entire story of how America came to be. Mm. For one thing, it's now been pretty well documented that the in-migration into the Americas from Asia thousands of years ago didn't necessarily unfold the way we think it did across the land bridge of the Aleutians during an interglacial period, but perhaps thousands of years earlier. by nomadic seafarers or ancient seafarers who crossed the North Pacific in vessels of some sort and came down the whole coast of the Americas. So some of the oldest artifacts that we have, that we found, have been found in places like San Diego County, like the Channel Islands, and indicate that really...
Did it predate 1492?
A long way, by maybe 17,000 years.
Wow.
And so really, you know, the first people that came into the Americas came through California. Hmm. At least we think so. And so when you look at this moment when the Europeans first arrived, again, that was 78 years before any pilgrims set eyes on Cape Cod, and more than 65 years before the English set foot at Jamestown. So it does allow us the right to say that San Diego and California was really one of the places where America began.
Now, before we go to break, I've got this ongoing debate with my mother. Is it Cabrillo or Cabrillo? Because I've heard it both ways, but I think the Portuguese is Cabrillo, right?
Well, so, is your mother a Portuguese ancestry or Spanish?
Which she's
is
a Tech.
Well, it'll be whatever you want.
So the Spanish pronounce it one way and the Portuguese another?
Well, here's the thing. That no one quite knows what that name really means. The individual we're talking about didn't take that name until very late in his life when he had acquired title and lands, and he needed to distinguish himself from all the other Juan Rodriguez's in the New World, of which there were a number. So he gave himself the name Cabrillo. There is good evidence that he was of Portuguese ancestry, perhaps on his mother's side, because of the reference to him being Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo Portuguese in the account of the historian Antonio de Herrera. However, he did work for the Spanish his entire career, and it was a Spanish expedition. So it allows us the opportunity to see how multicultural and what a diffuse background the whole project of exploration was.
So either one would be acceptable depending upon the context or who you're
speaking to. That's exactly right. Yeah, okay. Either one's acceptable, and either one has an equal claim.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but I think we're both right or both wrong depending upon your perspective. So, but anyway, let's digest that. We'll take our break. We'll come right back with more of the Maritime Museum right after this. Hang on. All right, we're back in the home stretch with It's Your Money and Your Life with our special guest, Dr. Ray Ashley and Dave McVane, both of the Maritime Museum of San Diego, discussing Cabrillo. It's Cabrillo. And we had some point. You wanted to make some points about him being a 10-year-old, right, Dave?
That was something, some of the things I've learned as we've gone through this process of building the ship. And, little fun facts, like I mentioned earlier, they had war horses on San Salvador. So when you look at that ship, think about these horses, that they never let the hooves touch the decks, but they were in slings, and they'd take the ship ashore as often as possible so they could run the horses and feed the horses. Huh. And another thing I recently learned was Cabrillo came to the New World as a 10-year-old. So if you weren't the oldest son, you didn't inherit anything in feudal Spanish society. And so you either joined the priesthood or you joined the army. And so he came over as a 10-year-old crossbowman. Hmm. And fought in Cuba, fought the Aztecs, and survived, which is sort of miraculous in his own right.
But had kind of a tragic ending, right? Tell us what happened to him after he... Dave?
Well, there's two accounts. One of them that he broke his arm, the other that he broke his leg, so we're not quite sure. He could have been either.
Mm-hmm.
The ships were in the Channel Islands, and he was apparently stepping ashore out of a boat to try and stop an altercation between his men and the Indians on one of the islands, and we don't know which one. And he slipped on rocks and he broke something and later died of gangrene from the
infection.
The wound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was like 3 days after he landed here, you're saying?
Well, no, he had been in California for about 6 to 7 weeks at that time, which is not very much considering almost everything in California is named after him.
Wow.
Certainly California's most famous tourist. But we don't know which island it was, so we don't know where he died exactly, nor quite why, nor what he looked like, nor quite exactly where he was born, and the record of his life is fairly dim in most cases. So he's barely there at all, which is an interesting thing given how many things have been named after him in California more than anyone else.
Now, the Spanish landing, do they think that's where he actually first landed, or don't we know?
No, that was a name given to a piece of property that's landfill, currently.
Do we think he first hit land in San Diego?
Well, he likely sailed into the bay and anchored either to the south of Ballast Point or to the north of it, because both sides of it were used as an anchorage at the time. And probably when they rowed ashore, stepped foot for the first place on what later became American soil on Ballast Point, just below Point Loma.
Below Point Loma. Okay, so I'm trying. Oh, so on the outside where the lighthouse, the old lighthouse is, or
well, would, more like where you know where the submarine base is now. Actually.
Okay. Okay, so kind of coming into the harbor.
Into the harbor. All right. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
and Joe, you know, a lot of this goes into, you know, we talk about Cabrillo the man, but really, as the Maritime Museum, we're celebrating maritime heritage. So the people are part of the heritage, of course, mm-hmm. but the technology of building this ship, and to be able to sail up the coast and explore like nobody else had before. And this ship will be a floating classroom. And so education is one of the primary roles for the Maritime Museum. And we'll have school kids on this ship, hopefully for the next 50 years at least.
So how often do you think you'll be taking the San Salvador out?
Well, we take the Californian out almost every day, and the San Salvador will probably go out a few days a week, don't you think?
Well,
Ray?
Especially during the first years of her life. She'll mm-hmm. be an ambassador for San Diego, and mm-hmm. we'll be making appearances at ports up and down the coast. That'll be a seasonal activity. The rest of the time she'll be at the museum, where she will be operating on shorter voyages, and also, just as Dave said, as a classroom every day. We currently have programs for about 15,000 children annually, school children in structured programs. So this will probably allow us to increase our capacity to about 20,000 kids annually.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I'm going to give the website again, sdmaritime.org. You should get on there and look at all the events and activities, and it's pretty robust. You guys have a lot of information on there. I was really pleasantly surprised to see all that. The America, this is the ship, that a replica of the first the first American ship that, or yacht that won the America's Cup, right?
Replica of the schooner yacht America of 1851, won the America's Cup, and she operates very frequently, taking people on whale watching expeditions. And in fact, America's about to go out and look at blue whales on a regular basis. You can find them out at sea almost every day now. They're just magnificent animals. And America is very successful at finding them and staying with them because, of course, as a sailing vessel, she's very quiet, you know, and, mm-hmm. and can get within viewing distance of the whales without disturbing them.
How big a crew is it needed to operate that?
For the America?
The schooner, yeah.
You know, I'm not America is actually a subtenant of ours. I think that they typically sail with a crew of about six or seven.
Huh, that's all, huh? Because I know you're telling me on Star of India, which is going out, and tell us again when that's going out.
2015, and we will typically sail with a crew of 60. And there'll typically also be about 140 guests aboard, so about 200 people, which is only about half the number she sailed with when she was once engaged in voyaging around the world.
And so that's, I think you said November of 2015, right?
Right. Her birthday was November 12th, 1863. She's the oldest active ship of any kind in existence. So as near as we can make it, the weekend closest to November 12th is when we try and take her sailing.
And then, but you, I think you or Dave mentioned earlier that you've got volunteers coming, what, every week or every day to train? Or
every Sunday.
Every Sunday.
The volunteer sail crew shows up every Sunday. They most of the year maintain the ships, but a few months before we're about to sail the Star of India, we go into a fairly intensive training period, not just for that, but for the other ships we operate too. So we'll put about 200 trained crew members out on the water when the Star of India sails.
And then who's at the helm? I assume it's you, right? Right?
No. Well, Star of India's captain's Captain Rich Gobin,
okay,
who is the head captain for Hornblower Dining Yachts, and he's been Star of India's captain for quite a few years now and has taken the lead role in training the crew and does a really, really good job.
Mm-hmm. If you haven't been down to stand on the Star of India, to stand on that ship, as I mentioned, last year was her 150th birthday. Abraham Lincoln was president when she was launched. So when you stand on that ship, you are standing on a lot of material that was put together when Abraham Lincoln was president, and we still sail her. We'll go out and we'll turn her and sail her, and it's an amazing feat.
Now, do you just take her out in the harbor, or do you actually get out beyond Point Loma? Or
we take her out to sea.
We
sail her in the bay on the way in, but the San Diego Bay really is a little bit too small for a ship the size of Star of India to operate comfortably, because it does take a lot of room. So we'll typically tow out to sea, and then once we're a mile or two away from the entrance of the bay, cast off, and then we'll sail all day. And it really is magnificent. It's a show that's provided every other year, you know, and if there's any way you can get out on a boat and observe it, there's
well, how difficult
quite like
is it? It must be a tough ticket in town to get on there, right?
It's pretty valuable real estate to on the deck of the Star of India yourself. But actually, when you're on the Star of India, it's one thing to be on her, but another, from any distance away, like on any of the excursion vessels, the museum sends out, the Californian, other vessels that people can go on, it is really something to see. And if you have friends that have a boat and you go out and watch it, especially at the end of the day when we're sailing in the bay and there's just this swarm of vessels escorting her in, it's really a magical moment.
Yeah.
We typically, on the second day, try and get all of our vessels to line up and line abreast, sail down the bay in perfect formation, playing bagpipes,
It
really is a stirring moment when that happens.
Now, the tall ships event on Labor Day, how many ships total do you think will be assembling?
It varies from year to year, but we will typically have assembled around 16 vessels of different kinds.
Wow.
Big, tall ships from locally and from some distance, usually.
Wow, that's outstanding. So, any closing thoughts? Anything we missed? Anything? I think you used to do an event where you'd show movies on one of the sails. You're still doing that? Or
we used to do that. Mm-hmm. And we stopped doing it at some point because, for one thing, Disney actually ceased allowing us to use their movies, and about a third of the swashbuckling epics made ended up being made by Disney. And there were so many other venues that now can cater to larger audiences, providing films like that mm-hmm. that we don't do that so much. We have this great thing we do at Halloween, where we do tours of the ship, with ghost stories from the Star video. That's a lot of fun. That's a really good family thing to do on Halloween. And there are events of various kinds. Dave had mentioned some of them earlier, but family days on the Star of India. We have her birthday party. We have generally every month there is something going on at the museum for
family.
And
the fleet's increased. I mean, I moved here in 77. How many ships then? It was just three. And now you guys are up to 10 with this new San Salvador to launch, right?
We're about to have a birthday party for the pilot. So we still have the pilot boat's 100 years old. And we have a party coming up in a couple of weeks for her. And the Californian is turning 30. So, yeah, that's a big party. And you can get the dates for that on the website again. And I would just encourage you, now's the time to come down to the San Salvador and look at her, because you're going to see her sailing, hopefully for the rest of our lives, but she's only going to be out of the water for about another 5 months.
Now, where will she be permanently docked? Down by Star Vineyard?
At the museum.
Oh, great.
At the site,
great. Well, gosh, it's been a real pleasure and honor having you gentlemen here, Dr. Ray Ashley and Dave McVain of the Maritime Museum, Executive Director, of course, and Chairman of the Board of Trustees. And we really appreciate you having you here. Richard, hope you had a good dinner tonight with your colleagues. And thanks to our sound tech, Eric Rubel-Calva, for making us sound good tonight. I apologize for my voice. I'll drink some more green tea and get over it. Thanks to Dave Sniff, our programming genius, and our con executive, Craig Blanke. We really appreciate all the hard work and the good stuff they do for us. And you guys have a great week. We'll see you next week. You have a good night, everybody. Take care.